as I go around the country and I see young professionals, middle professionals, Hispanic community. You know, I noticed that this is Maryland, Virginia, D.C., and when I explain to people in the administration and the Congress that the Hispanic community is not just concentrated in the Southwest, that it's all over the country, that what we have is an emerging economic and political class of younger Latinos that are going to be the backbone of this community in the next 20 years. You are here. I think this Ibero chamber is a reflection of that tremendous growth. I want to thank Beverly for that wonderful introduction. I think our community is enriched by your decision to come from Denver here. I also want to acknowledge Juan Sosa. Beverly did mention, but I also was involved in the Panama issue. Juan Sosa, you know, was one of the heroes that allowed that transition in Panama to become democratic and once again American interests protected. Let me also mention the presence of my friend Font here, the Cuban expert who works with me very closely on many foreign policy issues, most particularly right now the Cuban issue, which is surfacing once again as the election nears and as issues relating to the hemisphere become more important in our foreign policy. I was asked to talk a little bit about the politics of 1996, but then I'd like to just reflect a little bit on where I see the Hispanic community now. Last weekend, sort of as a sidelight to the Hispanic side of my talk, I spent it in Seville, Spain, all of 8 hours, to give a speech to an emerging group called the Spanish U.S. Business Council. And the decision that Spain was trying to make was as follows. Is España, la madre patria of many nations in the hemisphere, really more interested in staying as a European country and concentrating their trade and culture and economic activity as members of the European community, or shouldn't they start looking outward at Latin America, at the Hispanic community in the United States? That was the purpose of the conference. And I think what is happening around the world, and certainly around our hemisphere, and certainly within Spain right now, as they have an election that is coming up in March, and probably a new government, the Partido Popular, will take power, is this fundamental debate. And the question is, why this debate? And this debate is not just in terms of expanding the great culture of Spain. This debate is economic, and it represents the enormous economic challenges that face the world and face the United States and face nations in the European community. The competition of nations economically is going to be the main barometers of tension between countries, replacing the East-West confrontations, replacing some of the tribal and ethnic problems that exist in the country. And so Spain was trying to make this fundamental decision. They didn't decide it at this meeting, even though Felipe González was there, and Aznar was there, and the foreign minister. But the reason I'm mentioning this is everybody in the world is saying, what is this Hispanic community in the United States? What's in it for us if we reach out to them? And so the fundamental question that we have to ask ourselves is, what are we as a Hispanic community, and where should we go in the future? Here are my thoughts. And these are thoughts not universally shared by many Latinos and Hispanics in this country, because we do have a community that is very diverse. Some are very partisan on one side, others are nonpartisan. Others see themselves not as Hispanics, but primarily as Puerto Ricans or Cuban Americans or Central Americans or Mexican Americans, as I am. Some see the issues that deal with Latino issues as being too insurmountable to address, that we need some more time to define ourselves as a Latino community. For instance, Cuban Americans concerned about the Castro issue basically saying, this is fundamental to us, and we want the Hispanic community to respond to that. And when the Hispanic community in the past has not responded to that. They say, we're going to hold back on this unity issue. And Puerto Ricans saying, our problems are housing and jobs, and they're related to the Northeast. What do we have in common with Hispanics in Los Angeles or Texas or New Mexico, where you have the fastest growth taking place and you have dramatic changes in our population? Here's where I think we are going. Number one, we are growing dramatically to the point by the year 2010, we will be the largest minority in the country. Number two, our power is growing economically, not just as consumers, but as managers. And I bet looking around this chamber, you are all in the technical managerial class or close to it. Number three, our community, at the same time that it is growing, is not necessarily, in my judgment, developing a common agenda. As we grow and as we become larger parts of communities, as other sectors and populations see us grow, they have natural reactions. Those natural reactions sometimes are of fear. They're sometimes of envy. But certainly they can't ignore us. And as what happens in states like California and Arizona and others, they see us as threats. And so you get these propositions coming up that deal with illegal immigration. Or you see these initiatives on affirmative action that basically are saying, you know, we're going to blame the problems of our community on this emerging group that basically cannot defend themselves because mainly that they are not voters. And secondly, within the Hispanic community, they notice that we are not always together. So what is my prescription for this? I don't have all the answers. But first, I think we should think of ourselves as much as we can as Hispanics, as Latinos. Put aside our differences on a national basis and see if we can develop a common set of agenda items, economic development, jobs, opposition to English-only movements, supporting reasonable affirmative action. We don't necessarily need quotas. But we do need equal opportunity in both the federal and the corporate marketplace. What else is something that unites us? I think this emerging economic interdependence of nations, where internationally we can see ourselves as bridges between the United States and Latin America, or as bridges, as we depended on this debate in Spain this weekend, between us and the so-called Madre Patria. I like to say that Madre Patria because my mother's, who is a Mexican, her father is a Spaniard. My mother, even though she's been to Spain once, thinks of herself as a member of the royal family of Spain, which is not the case, especially because she traces her ancestry to Bilbao, which has had some difficulty within the Spanish political culture. I made one of those mistakes just like when I was with Saddam Hussein. I showed him the soles of my foot, which is a supreme insult in Arab culture. I opened my speech in Seville saying that I had roots in Bilbao. That necessarily did not go over terribly well. It was like saying that your main claim to fame was being a juror on the O.J. Simpson trial. But nonetheless, it happened. And my reality is that we as a community have to act smart. I say, and you're talking to the vice chairman of the Democratic Party, I think more of our interests lie with the Democratic Party, but that doesn't mean that we can't have those in our community here be active in the Republican Party. As long as we help each other, as long as we recognize that we have a diversity of interests, and should there be a Republican administration, I think it's important to have Hispanics, high prominent Hispanics, in that administration. We should tell the Democratic Party that we shouldn't be taken for granted. I say that blue in the face, but sometimes it happens. But they take us for granted sometimes because sometimes we are not united. We don't present a common front. And I think perhaps here in Virginia and Maryland, you do a lot better than we do in the Southwest, where because we have numbers, because we already have access to the political establishment, sometimes we get a little soft. And we run our own people against each other. If every Hispanic district in the country, in the Congress, were reflective of population, we would have 30 members of Congress right now. Instead, we have 20. In El Paso, for instance, a non-Hispanic has represented that area in a community that is 70% Hispanic, and that is because of divisions in our own community. I say that the time has come to try to develop that common agenda, and I think where you can play crucial roles is in an economic issue. You're in Washington, D.C., a center of government and trade. I think there's great potential for this Chamber of Commerce to deal with international missions to Latin America. I think you should get involved in the ongoing debate on fast track with Chile. That's probably going to be the next one. And then we're going to look at new schemes that involve Central America or the Mercosur countries. But in order for that to be successful, we need retailing. And regrettably, our foreign policy doesn't pay attention to Latin America as much as it should. Our concentration is on Asia, on the Middle East, on Europe, and when it comes to our own hemisphere, I think people seem to think that the main problems are immigration or drugs and not necessarily the tremendous economic growth that is also happening in our hemisphere. The tremendous activity, I was thinking of Juan Sosa. I had a chance of meeting the new president of Panama just 2 weeks ago, a dynamic guy who is privatizing, who is moving ahead with free trade agreements of his own, who was talking about good, strong relationships with the United Nations, with the United States, and say, all right, if you want an American military presence, this is what we want. And it's not handouts. It's basically trade and commerce. And I think this is what is emerging. And these are excellent opportunities for the Ibero Chamber here to be bridges in this process. And you can do it. You probably are asking yourselves, how can I, as one individual that perhaps has a managerial or computer company in Maryland, be part of this? I think you can do that if you become part of missions that go to Latin America, or perhaps you might consider organizing one yourself. Let me address the political situation in the House and in the Congress right now and in the government shutdown. I hope everybody here is going back to work that works in the government. But we have a very serious situation right now, where basically you have a very determined new majority in Congress that doesn't want to blink, and you have a president that doesn't want to blink either, because both sides are reading polls at this moment that say, if you blink, you lose, and you lose big time. And right now, the Republican majority in the Congress is probably facing polls that are more decisive, that say, if we blink, all of this talk about a new majority and a realignment in American politics is not going to happen. So what is the result? The result is the continued stalemate. The result for our country is not good. The president just had to cancel his trip to Japan. He had to cancel a meeting with 18 Asian leaders to talk about free trade. This is serious. This is not good. Tomorrow a vote, an acrimonious vote in the House of Representatives, on the Bosnia issue, basically saying to the president, you cannot use troops in Bosnia, which is going to be controversial anyway, until you get approval from Congress. Well, there's a slight problem. We are negotiating in Dayton, Ohio, with the three Yugoslav leaders in a very tense situation. And imagine Begin and Sadat being in Camp David, and the Congress passes a resolution saying, we don't want you to reach agreement. That's a comparable situation now. And in the past, our foreign policy has been bipartisan. That has not happened because of the acrimony that has developed over the dramatic changes in our political system. I predict it'll be resolved, but I think it's going to be another week. And it's important for us in the Democratic Party not just to whine and to say, you Republicans are cruel and bad and don't care about kids and education and the environment. We have to have alternatives. And I will admit, as a strong Democrat, that sometimes we haven't had those alternatives, that we haven't been identified as a party of growth and economic activity and having new ideas. In fact, some joke that our last idea was during the New Deal. I think that's going a little far, but at the same time, as a proud Democrat, I resent the fact that sometimes in the agendas of the Congress and the debates that you have, you're debating Republican ideas, and our Democratic ideas, our think tank, our new emergence of younger people perhaps needs to be energized to develop those new ideas. There's nothing wrong with saying, when you get defeated, as we did in 1994, you have to reflect and say, how did this happen? Why is it that after 40 years, were Democrats trounced out of the House and Senate? Well, I think we have to not just say that we failed to communicate our accomplishments or our good looks or whatever, but we have to come up with alternatives. Point number two, I think you are going to continue to see in the days ahead a change in, regrettably, the composition of people in the Congress that deal with foreign policy, that affects you, with international affairs. Regrettably, in the House and in the Senate, a new group of Republicans and Democrats is coming in that is not internationalist, that is not recognizing that international trade and the ability to speak languages and the ability to engage for our own benefit in trade is the way America should go. That is a threat to you if you're a Republican, and that is a threat to you if you're a Democrat. I think it's critically important that we recognize as Americans that the world is not just one American system, that we're now in an interdependent world where perhaps someday we'll be thinking of ourselves as citizens of this hemisphere rather than just as citizens of this country. It could be that the building of trading blocks will move very much in that direction. And when I debate people in English only, I say to them, do you realize that 30% of the commercial decisions made in the United States, remember this, commercial decisions, are you going to buy this television? Are you going to buy this podium? Are made in a language other than English. And that 70% of those, 30% of those commercial decisions are made in Spanish. Now, that is not anything to do with culture or retaining your language, which is important. That is a straight commercial decision, and we should not retreat in this isolationism both abroad and within our own country to close the door to a community like ours that has enormous potential. When I look around this room, I see enormous potential. The challenge is going to be, can we make that enormous potential so that someday that we will not just be treated as a number, someday that we will not be treated as a community that just belongs to one political party, although I'm speaking against my own interests. Or thirdly, whether we're viewed as a community that can not only be active citizens of this great country, which we are and have been, but can also be bridges, puentes, to other cultures, especially in our hemisphere. We are talking about tremendous growths in trade, in economic opportunity, in trading arrangements, in telecommunications, where we can communicate immediately between this city and Tierra del Fuego, or Santiago and Canada. And the question is, are we going to be part of this? This is the future. And I think with our common language, with our common heritage, this is where internationally we need this niche to be. So regrettably, I have to go back to the House of Representatives, where we will continue to engage in, unfortunately, quite a bit of rhetoric and politics. Last night, the Republicans, for the first time, I think, in 2 weeks, got very smart. You know, they had pushing the Medicare cuts and education cuts, and I think they realized they were taking a big beating. But last night, and luckily it was around midnight, where probably you didn't see it in the news, they came up with a simple continuing resolution that said that till December 6th, we proceed and open the Congress, and that we commit and we say to the President, the only issue that we can debate with each other is whether you, Mr. President, agree that we balance the budget in 7 years. Now, I had voted for that before. I had voted for that in a constitutional amendment and several alternatives, as had many Democrats. So we said, well, how can we vote against this? And the argument you make is that it backs the President up. And it jams his negotiating authority. But basically, the message to the White House is, you know, this is going to be hard to oppose again. So let's come up with some alternatives. We can't always be picturing ourselves as on the defensive. So we're heading back to come up with some alternatives that perhaps can be sustained. But at the same time, don't expect a quick resolution. But this is also, in conclusion, part of our democracy. You know, we can criticize ourselves as a country. We're good at that. The press is good at that. You know, the Congress is run by a bunch of incompetents and crooks. But I can tell you, every time I step outside this country, I get politicians and I get business people asking me, how does your system work? You know, in your disagreements and in your fights, we see democracy at work. We see change taking place by the will of the people. And we love that and emulate that. But you can take satisfaction that even though we're very self-critical internationally and around the world, we're still viewed as having a viable system. Ketengokeir, I wish you the best. I hope you think of yourselves as an Ibero chamber that can come to the Hispanic caucus in Congress and say, I may not have a representative in Virginia or Maryland or the district, but we need you. We need to work together. I am here to reach out to you. We haven't done a good job in that. I don't know if you know too many members of our caucus. We probably only hit you for contributions or to going to our dinner. But we need as a community to communicate more. The economic community, which is you, and the political community, which is ours. And we're not just Democrats. We've got Cuban American Republicans. We've got Texas Republicans. We're growing. We're changing. And that diversity is our strength. And that challenge that we have as a community is going to determine whether we are part of this American power and economic structure or we are not. I'm confident that we will. Que Dios los bendiga. Ahora sí ya me voy. And take care of yourselves. I would like to introduce to you our special guest today, starting with Mr. Norman Carter, who is the manager of Minority Business and Economic Development for PEPCO. Where are you, Norman?
Not here, my God.
How about Eduardo Gonzalez Jimenez, former ambassador of Mexico to Norway and personal secretary to President Echevarria? Ms. Janet Farrell, Vice President of First National Bank of Maryland. Mr. Darío Márquez, President of MVM and our 1995 Gala Chair. Nice to see you, Darío. Mr. Roscoe Swan, Director of Minority Business Development for Amtrak Corporation. Mr. Randy Shelton, who's Vice President for Small Business for Signet Bank. Is Al Zapanta here? Al Zapanta, Executive Vice President of U.S.-Mexico Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Manuel Geraldo, DWIACC Past President and Chair of the Nominations and Elections Committee. Mr. Geraldo, nice to see you again. And I'd like to give a warm welcome to Mr. George Matos, the Vice President of Operations for Primus Communications. Can I ask you to come up to the microphone a second, sir? Mr. Matos, say hi to the crowd here.
Thank you very much for sponsoring this one. Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is George Matos. I'm the Vice President of Primus Telecommunications. It's kind of been our pleasure to sponsor this chamber meeting. And it's always, as Paulo's put me in this real tough position to follow some great acts, and the congressman was exceptionally well. But being in the telecommunications business, we're used to following great acts, and they're called MCI and AT&T. And having been with both of them over the last 22 years, I think I'm with the best one right now. So if I could, just for a few minutes, give you kind of a brief history of where we started from and where we are today. Back 18 months ago, there was three people. Paul Singh, who apologized for not being here. He's actually raising money in this company. You have to raise it consistently. John Mellick and myself sit in an office back in Greensboro, drive trying to figure out how to start a business. Today, from ground zero, and due to a recent acquisition that took place only the past 2 days, we're a $200 million company. We've got offices. Thank you. We've got offices. Our corporate headquarters is located here in McLean, Virginia. We've got our switches here in Washington, D.C. We've got offices in Miami, Mexico City, London, Australia, and we're putting new offices in New York City, Chicago, Los Angeles, and Dallas. So I think in an 18-month period, if you wonder why I got a few gray hairs, I didn't have anyone who started, but they're here now. Our plans for the future and what we do, you know, people say, what is Primus Telecommunications? Primus Telecommunications is no different than an MCI or an AT&T. We're a long-distance provider, calling cards, debit cards, 800 service, all the same things you get with one of the larger carriers you'll get with Primus. And the difference, they say, what is the difference? And how can you sell it so cheap? We don't sell it that cheap. Cheap is not something we sell. We sell a quality service. What we try to do is look at the small, medium-sized, multinational businesses, and we can provide the same type of services that AT&T would provide only to their larger customers. At the same time, we work on ethnic markets, and we've got, you know, like I said, each one of the countries we've established kind of a long-distance business where we're going to take all of Europe within the next 2 or 3 years. So hopefully, I don't want to take a lot of your time because I know my food was getting a little cold, and I'm sure the rest of these will. But I'd like to spend some time afterwards trying to talk to each and every one of you. And if you have any questions, please feel free to stop by and say hi. Okay? Thank you very much. Thanks.
Next, I'd like to introduce our Executive Vice President, Ambassador Juan Sosa.
You know, this morning in the Washington Post, there was a column that I'm going to read the pertinent parts. It said, NBC News yesterday made it abundantly clear that Chief White House Correspondent Brian Williams has been tapped to be the eventual successor for Tom Brokaw's anchor job on NBC Nightly News. It says all of the things, and then it says, in his current assignment, Williams will also have a big election year role covering the Clinton White House. The New Deal is expected to boost Williams' take-home pay to some $1 million a year. I wanted to mention something about a esteemed member of our board, Ricardo. Where is Ricardo Villanueva? We're facing an election year next year. ABC, NBC, CBS, PBS, CNN, they all got together and they made a deal for covering the election. In fact, they're coming out with a piece called Election 95. Next year is going to be Election 96. And Ricardo Villanueva, who's president of Avisos Production, was recruited to do some coverage in the Washington area. And Ricardo, the enterprising person that he is, quickly got on the job, and he made his first interview, and he wants to share that interview with us. So we're going to take a few minutes. We have two monitors, and Ricardo, could you start the monitor?
By the way, I wanted to be hiding. I'm going to be hiding after I present this.
Good afternoon. This is Ricardo Cupo with Campaign 95. The city of Washington is full of unforgettable political events such as the Kennedy-Nixon election, the election of Ronald Reagan, the Martin Luther King March, and more recently the 1 Million Man March. But Washington has never witnessed a political event such as the GWIACC election. And we have here our political analyst, Juan Donaldson. Juan, any comments on this election?
It has been an exciting election, Ricardo. We had 347,483 phone calls, 287,444 pieces of mail. We had five attempted assassinations and two almost kidnappings. We had calls from the DNC and the RNC trying to recruit our candidates because they've never seen such political talent, and even Colin Powell called And if he had these people, our candidates, in his camp, I think he would have run for president instead of deciding not to.
My goodness. What issues do you think dominated the campaign?
Our polls are inconclusive. We had candidates run on experience, others run on commitment, others ran on youth, others ran on vision. We do not have any contracts with government institutions, so the contract with America was not an issue. The budget was not an issue. Congressman Richardson's visit to Burma, Haiti, and North Korea were not an issue. So, you know, we just don't really know if there was a dominant issue in the campaign.
What is your forecast on the results of the election?
That's a tough call. We have 15 top candidates for 7 board seats. The winner is the chamber, because any one of the 15 would be a great member of the board. However, we have to realize that 8 would not make it. The road to political success is littered with setbacks along the way. We saw Richard Nixon losing a gubernatorial race before becoming president. So did Bill Clinton. Newt Gingrich did not make a race for the U.S. House one time, and now he's the Speaker of the House. O.J. Simpson had a failed marriage before he married the second time. So we need to understand that not everybody can make it, but if you're persistent, you eventually can make it.
Well, what is your advice to the candidates who did not make it this year?
Keep running. The chamber needs you. If I were you, I would start my campaign today. You have a lot of people in this lunch. Every one of them is a potential voter for next year. Start your campaign right now.
Thank you, Juan. Well, for all of you who do not make it this year, the chamber is providing free psychological services so you can deal with this emotional challenge. We'll be back very soon with Campaign 95.
By the way, Ambassador Sosa wrote the script.
We had the summary of the votes for the first part of the luncheon. Myself and the nominating committee were out back to the room to the side, and we were taking the ballots of the votes. And what I'd like to present now are the voting elections results. The highest vote getter was Will Sosa. He's been reelected. And besides Will, the 6 new directors are as follows: Marissa Costa, Zenaida Mustafi, Carlos Guzman, Steven Usera, Jorge Perez Ponce, and Joe Caracuel. I want to thank the membership at large for their participation. I've been with the chamber a long time, and I can remember where we would essentially ask people to serve on the board. And to see the way it's developed over the past 3 years just warms my heart. And hopefully next year we'll have perhaps 15 or 20 candidates to run. Thank you again. Thank you for the continued support. And congratulations to all the new directors.
Ladies and gentlemen, before we conclude, I want to again remind you of the banking seminar this afternoon. There, you will have an opportunity to meet one-on-one individually with members of different banks and bring your concerns and your interests with respect to financing with them. So please avail yourself of the opportunity and take advantage of it, and I hope to see you all there, as I'm sure Fannie Mae is looking forward to hosting you. Thank you.
Thank you.